ballistic is not an issue for the Middle Ages. What these maps try to do is not tell you what the world looked like, but tell you what the world meant. Maps are theological artifacts. And that might sound real strange to us, but it obviously wasn't strange in the Middle Ages when you could have a map hanging above the altar in a church.
Cultural Contours, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with Sylvia Tomash of Hunter College and Sara Suleri of Yale University. Sylvia Tomash talks about maps and the medieval geographical imagination. Later, Sara Suleri discusses literature and colonialism in English India. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Maps are a commonplace of the modern world, symbolizing commerce and culture, both local and universal. But according to Sylvia Tomash, a professor of English at Hunter College, to the medieval mind, maps signified not so much longitude and latitude as a theological view of the cosmos. She also argues that medieval conceptions of the physical world had direct consequences for the literature of the Middle Ages. Sylvia Tomash.
There's a famous map called the Ebstorf map, 13th century map. It was 13 feet square. It no longer exists, unfortunately. It was destroyed in World War II bombing. But we have facsimiles of it. And this map shows behind the circular form of the three known continents, Asia, Europe, and Africa, the head, the hands, the feet of Christ. And that map, and that's the map that was above the altar. That map makes a statement about where the world comes from and where it's all going.
This is a statement of reassurance, isn't it? I mean, this is, after a fashion, a kind of consolation to people in, as you say, these medieval religious gathering places. They would look at this thing up behind the altar.
I think, among other things, it can give reassurance. In a way, it also gives a command. It's proscriptive. It tells you, it's both things. It's prescriptive. It tells you how to get to heaven, what the path to salvation is. It's also proscriptive. It tells you where not to go.
Wouldn't that be wonderful if it were all so simple? What about the scientific element? Did, again, the medieval imagination embrace that dimension? Was this a form of science?
Well, science, again, in the Middle Ages had another meaning. They weren't concerned with science in terms of accuracy and objectivity, but they did, in many cases, incorporate information they knew about the actual shape of places, the actual topography that they gathered from other sources. These could be put on these maps as well.
Were the people who produced these maps, Sylvia, were they, what did they call themselves? Map makers? I mean, were they church people? What?
We don't know. For the most part, maps, like other medieval texts, are unsigned. They're anonymous. Like the great cathedrals, very often we don't know who worked on them, who made them.
So does that help? Does that make it more difficult to figure out what they mean?
I think they mean well. Sometimes they do tell us what they mean. They tell us this is a pilgrimage. They tell us this was created for the glory of God. But again, I'd say meaning has another sense in the Middle Ages. It's not scientific meaning, but significance. What does the world mean? Means how are you as a pilgrim looking for salvation, to use what you find in this world created by God.
The audience for these maps, therefore, was very wide. I mean, even though literacy would not be widespread, you would have many people looking at these things and taking from them this sort of implicit theology without having to read words.
Sure. One thing we know about medieval churches, which is very different from our concept of how churches work today, is that they were elaborately decorated. There were tapestries, there were frescoes, there were still, of course, stained glass windows, all of which were books for the illiterate.
Tell me about some of the illustrations. How elaborate was this? I mean, and here we're, after a fashion, talking about evidence, how you figure out what these things really look like then.
Well, the Ebstorf map, for instance, is covered, remember, 11 feet square, but it's a circular form within that. It is covered with pictures, with texts. Some of the information is historical. So there are real places. There's Rome, there's Jerusalem, of course, right at the center of the map. But there are also legendary places. places, Troy, there were places they weren't sure existed, like Cathay, which Marco Polo, of course, did know existed.
Did these maps therefore represent an interplay between paganism and Christianity, the ascendancy of one, the decline of the other?
I don't think so. I think what they show is the all-inclusiveness of the Christian world vision, that everything, since God created everything, everything could be included in a map, including monstrous figures, for instance.
What do these maps have to do with cultural identity? How do you make the connection between place and location and personal sense of oneself?
There's a particular kind of map called the T and O map, which is a late medieval development.
T and O.
T is picture a T in a circle. That's the O.
Okay.
The O is the circumfluent ocean. The T divides the three known continents, Asia, Europe, and Africa. And right at the center there, where the bar and the column of the T meet, that's where Jerusalem is.
Latitude and longitude, sort of.
No. Well, latitude and longitude didn't exist either.
Yeah.
But this is a notion of place that develops late in the Middle Ages, from the 11th century on. This kind of map, putting Jerusalem at the center of the known world, developed. And this, I think, can be connected to other important events in the culture, like the Crusades, like, unfortunately, like the beginnings of the Inquisition. That at this time, Europe was beginning to think of itself as Europe, as a Christian community that could incorporate theoretically the rest of the world, but in practical terms, they kept coming up against the Mongols or the Muslims, and so there was a certain anxiety in the culture, and these maps arose out of that anxiety.
Do we look at these medieval maps and say that they, what, have particular kinds of influences on the development of what we now call colonialism?
In the sense that they're totalizing objects, they present the world, at least potentially, incorporative into a system that already exists, a system of European domination. Now, it wasn't imperial domination in the Middle Ages, but I think we can see how it could transfer to that system.
In other words, they don't necessarily imply what we now call cultural, as you just said, domination. They don't necessarily make of these medieval people villains who were going out and doing bad things to virgin territories and unconquered people.
That certainly that is one, obviously, one way in which these notions could be used, but it's not the only way. There was both a positive and a negative side to this kind of totalizing vision.
Did they talk about things like this? I mean, in the sort of literary and popular discourse that you look at as you're writing this book, Sylvia, did people talk to themselves about, are we doing wrong? Are we bad people? And
certainly throughout the later Middle Ages, there were arguments about what's called the just war. When are you justified in making war against others? And this was a serious argument. They were concerned with this, and you see this in the Middle Ages and then through the Renaissance discoveries and explorations.
Back to the maps themselves. You mentioned, tell me again the name of the large map.
Epsdorf.
Epsdorf. Is that your favorite? Do you have a favorite as you look at these wonderful documents?
I gave a lecture recently and it had a slideshow attached to it and found myself saying for almost every other map, now here's an example of my favorite map. I think maps in general are just my favorite objects.
Are we that much more sophisticated, all of our technology and all of that, at making maps than the medieval imagination?
Certainly we're technologically more sophisticated. In some ways I think we're even more naive.
Okay.
Because a medieval map maker understood what the purpose of his map was, to show the profusion, diversity of life as it was created, he understood what his purpose was. Modern map makers tend to be so technical they forget, and they think that if we could simply slice the world up into these laminations, we could have meteorological maps, route maps, oceanographical maps, topographical maps, demographic maps, celestial maps. If we could slice the world into all these slices, somehow it would add up to a full picture of the universe. But none of these does that, and all of them don't do that either, because one thing we don't think about is the purpose of it all. At least, we think that's a question that's not scientific.
Sylvia, tell me about the relationship between these wonderful medieval maps and the literary culture of the day. For example, you look at people like Chaucer.
And one of the things I've discovered, and this is the heart of my project here at the National Humanities Center, is connecting geographical conceptions and literary productions. I went through graduate school, I have my degree in English, and I had no idea about geography, let alone about maps.
You said you were in a library one day and started looking at maps and said, wait a minute, nobody's ever really looked at this connection.
That's right. I was in the New York Public Library. There's a map room there, which I never knew. Growing up in New York using that library, I never knew this map room existed. Uh-huh. But the curators were so helpful. I didn't know what to ask for because I hadn't seen these materials. And they just kept bringing out books and manuscripts. It was wonderful.
How about Chaucer? How do you
How
use him?
How about Chaucer? In the chapter I have on Chaucer, after I looked at all these medieval maps, I then went and read some geographical treatises. I went back and reread Chaucer, and much to my surprise, my amazement, and my delight, all these geographical references started popping out of the text, terminology, information that I didn't know Chaucer knew because I didn't know it. I went back specifically and reread The Knight's Tale. And in The Knight's Tale, the Theban Duke Theseus constructs a great amphitheater for a tournament between two of his knights who are contending for the love of fair Emily.
And this is the world and what, God and the devil fighting over the human soul?
I don't think it's God and the devil, but I do think it's a reproduction in miniature of the Teo map.
Uh-huh.
And what happens in that case is that because Theseus is a pagan, he doesn't put any Jerusalem at the center. He doesn't put the equivalent of Jerusalem at the center, and therefore his task fails. He doesn't create a world. He doesn't create order. Everything falls apart.
You could be giving me a sort of a mini allegory here of the secularization of our modern world that we live in. But again, Sylvia, all of our technology notwithstanding, do we not look at maps today and take from them any kind of personal import the way the medieval imagination did?
The way the medieval imagination did, no. We try to locate ourselves individually. We are, Western culture is so individualistic. And if we have a route map, we think about, okay, how do I get from Chicago to Des Moines? But we don't think about, what does it mean that you can get from Chicago to Des Moines? Uh-huh. What will you find along the way? What kind of weird, mysterious life will exist, and how will you find your way through it to your true goal?
Does that mean that these medieval people were really different from you and me?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. Some people teach the Middle Ages its relevance. They try to make the Canterbury Tales, for instance, into these funny stories about people just like us.
Yeah.
I teach from the other tack. I teach by what's known as alterity, otherness. And I try to show that we can appreciate it. We can love it. We can laugh at it, or with Chaucer and his wonderful characters, but we can never think like a 14th century English person.
Sylvia, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are a professor at Hunter College up in New York. Your book is The Medieval Geographical Imagination. Sylvia Tomash, thank you and good luck in your work.
Thank you. It was great fun.
It's Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Cultural Contours. Join me now for a conversation with Sara Suleri of Yale University. We'll talk about her new book, The Rhetoric of English India. Sara Suleri recently visited the National Humanities Center to participate in the Jesse Ball DuPont Summer Seminars for Liberal Arts College teachers. In her book, Sara Suleri challenges the notion that otherness is central to an understanding of colonialism. Where many writers see a strict separation between works by Western and non-Western writers, and between dominant and conquered races, Sara Suleri argues that English and Indian idioms not only collide, but collude. In tracing the genealogy of colonial complicity, Suleri looks at a range of writers, from the historical to the contemporary, including Edmund Burke and E.M. Forster. Sara Suleri.
I would certainly not deny the fact of collision, but I would say complicity and collusion cannot be overlooked.
How is this, in the simple sense that cultures have to, they bump up against one another and they have to learn and work with one another?
Cultures infect one another, and I don't use the word infection as a pejorative.
Uh-huh. You see this thing as essentially what, a healthy relationship?
No, colonialism is never healthy, but strict lines of demarcation between the colonizer and the colonized can't be rigidly maintained.
How do we get behind these stereotypes? I mean, we go to a movie like, or read a book like A Passage to India, we read read the fiction of Rudyard Kipling, and we have this notion of the dominant and the dominated. It's all in black and white. You're taking us beyond that.
I would hope so. And I would, let me say that the film of A Passage to India has very little to do with the book. Uh-huh. The book, on the other hand, is very interested in showing you how powerlessness obtains between both the colonialists there, as well as the colonized.
Uh-huh. All right, well, we'll come back to E.M. Forster in a few minutes, Sarah. Let's begin with some rather distant history here. Tell me about the figure of Edmund Burke and his relationship to the Indian subcontinent. He gave a couple of famous speeches on the floor of Parliament. Talk to me for a moment about him.
I certainly shall. Edmund Burke is a very misread author in contemporary times. People think of him as a conservative. They look at his work on the American Revolution and on the French Revolution, and they totally ignore what he spent his life doing, which is writing about India.
He was interested as much in literature as he was in politics and the law. Have I got that right?
Yes. He started off his career as writing about aesthetics.
Uh-huh.
And then moved on to being a parliamentarian, and ultimately spent the bulk of his life trying to get Warren Hastings impeached.
All right, now Hastings was the man who was the first governor general.
Of Bengal, yes.
Of Bengal, and he was the one who was being impeached on charges of corruption and mismanagement. What was the case, for and against this man that Burke participated in?
Well, do you remember the Oliver North trial?
I do indeed.
It was just the same as Oliver North in the 18th century.
A single figure sort of arrogating to himself a lot of authority. And
all the rhetoric of accountability was established by that very trial.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly enough, even though Hastings was acquitted, the trial proved the obsolescence of impeachment in Great Britain. It was the last impeachment trial.
All right, now Burke wanted the English out of India.
No.
I mean, now this is one of the stereotypes, that he fought for the Americans and that he wanted the English out of India. Tell me about this.
He wanted the British to rule India well.
Uh-huh.
Of course Burke was an imperialist, but he says if we can't rule this country well, we'd better quit.
I see. So that was his reasoning.
Yeah.
And is that what governed our notions of the relationship from that time forward?
Not really, because Burke was soon seen to be a madman. And one of the most famous lines about him during the trial was, someone wished that Hastings would run away and Burke after him. So they really didn't buy his particular argument. But this certainly was Burke's passionate reasoning.
All right, now, how does all of this connect with the title of your book, Sarah Suleri, which is The Rhetoric of English India? I take it that you are writing about Burke, for example, and other figures.
Indeed I am, and I use the word rhetoric simply because I want to emphasize that I'm talking about representations of British politics in India, not about the historical facts necessarily themselves.
All right, now a closer example to us in time would be the fiction of E.M. Forster.
Mm-hmm.
Here we're moving from the British colonial presence on the Indian subcontinent during the time of the history itself to these representations in our own, in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this an important book to you?
A Passage to India is surely one of the most haunting novels ever written about the Indian subcontinent. For one thing, it tries to demystify the notion that India is this exotic, wonderful, magnificent place.
All right, what happens between, Adela Quested, is that her name,
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Aziz?
Yes.
Recapitulate that incident for me briefly, and then let's cast it in the language of post-imperialism, or at least the literary representation of imperialism.
Okay. Mrs. Moore and Adela Quested arrive in India to visit Mrs. Moore's son, whom Adela is meant to marry. The two women are very anxious to see the real India, not colonial India.
They just don't want to spend time in the bazaars.
No, they don't want to spend time in the clubs. They'd love to spend time in the bazaars.
I see. Fair enough.
And in the process of an elaborate series of accidents, they get invited by one Dr. Aziz to visit him in the Maribor Caves.
Right, now this is a man who begins, at least in the novel, he's represented to us as having a great passion for the English and a great devotion, enthusiasm, and he ends bitterly disappointed at his relationship to the British.
He's never passionately devoted to the British, and Forster is extremely accurate in his social satire of the Anglo-Indian scene.
Uh-huh.
It's just that he responds to kindness, and Mrs. Moore is kind to him, as is Fielding. Off all they go to a picnic in the Maribor Caves, a pretty foolish thing to do at the best of times. And
what, dangerous places?
No, not dangerous. You don't go. It's very hot in India. You don't go for picnics in caves.
I see.
And then what happens is, shortly thereafter, Aziz loses Adela. And the next thing we know, it's a cut, and Aziz is being arrested for rape.
All right, now something happens in those caves. I mean, there is an insult that gets delivered. What is it? Do we know ever?
No, we're never told.
Mm-hmm.
But after a very dramatic trial scene, Adela Quested recants. She suddenly says, nothing happened. So she, of course, is ostracized by the community.
All right, now are we to take all of this as some sort of an emblem of the, the ambiguity that is essentially at the heart of the meeting of these two cultures?
Yes. And we see it in through, of course, Forster's own interests, which are not very much in developing the women characters, but are extremely devoted to mapping out the failures of the relationship between the two males and the opposite cultures they represent.
All right, now, one of the words that you use in describing this this series of encounters here is Forster's imperial erotic. You talk about a disembodied homoeroticism that goes on in this novel. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that if A Passage to India had been written in, let's say, 1992, the homosexual relationship between Dr. Aziz and Mr. Fielding would not be so deeply submerged and so subtextual.
Am I to take this, Sarah, as some sort of, again, an emblem of imperialism itself?
Yes. I feel very strongly that, according to current mythology, imperialism is always depicted as a rape,
uh-huh,
which makes the colonized territory somehow female and the entering colonizer a male. Now, when you look closely at some of these texts, you realize that, in fact, what emerges is far more homoeroticism between two men.
Mm-hmm. You use, for example, in your book here, let's just put it this way, an unmentionable word of the anatomy for the Maribor Caves themselves when we think about what might happen between two gay lovers, as a matter of fact.
Well, I would say that that's absolutely metaphoric. I'd never argue that it was a literal relationship.
Fair enough.
But it has to end at a moment of parting when Fielding looks at Aziz and says, why can't we be friends now? But the entire cosmology of India does not want it. Not yet, not now.
All right, now the sexual dimension aside, are we to take the notion of complicity and collusion as, what, an alternative reading to our understanding? When I say our, that is to say the Western ethnocentric way of looking at what we now call the Third World? We should acknowledge this complicitous relationship and, what, build on it?
I think so. If basically, my book is about the anxiety of empire. And it tries to set out the fact that powerlessness also attaches to the colonizer.
Uh-huh.
And that the psychic experience of colonizing territory is in itself very deranging.
Sarah, so Larry, talk to me on a personal level. Here you are, a Pakistani woman. You are educated in Lahore. You now teach at Yale University. You're something of an exotic. I mean, as it were, you embody these very tensions that you write about, the traveling back and forth among and between cultures. I take it that this personal dimension is important to you.
The last thing in the world I would want to be is exotic. And I always tell people, no, I happen to be very, very real. And since I was tired of answering questions like this, uh-huh, I sat down when I got my first leave, and instead of writing an academic book, I wrote a so-called memoir. So it isn't a memoir, but it's an attempt to almost deconstruct notions of exoticism and of the vast distances between these two cultures.
Am I to take it, therefore, Sara Solari, that you really believe that people have more in common than they have things to worry and fight and fret about, things that separate them?
I think we have lost a sense of commonality that should be resuscitated in a post-humanist language. So I'm not asking us to go back to the 18th century and set up notions, universal notions of human nature. That I do not believe in. But there still is, in the very idiosyncrasies of our individual stories, there is some commonality. And that, I think, one should share. We share stories.
Should I accuse you of being a little naive? That is to say, that if we share these narratives, however powerful and different they may be, that here is a means by which we approach, not solve, but we approach the political and the ethnic and the cultural differences that separate, well, what we call the first and the third world.
People usually call me world weary rather than naive, but I shall be happy to on this score, actually go along with you. Yes, I think the more stories people tell, and the more you listen, the more sobering various ethnic, religious, cultural problems become.
Sara Solari, I want to thank you for your participation on Soundings. You are a professor at Yale University. Your most recent book is The Rhetoric of English India. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Thank you for coming by, and good luck in your work.
Thank you very much.
It's Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations with Sylvia Tomash of Hunter College and Sara Solari of Yale University. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Sylvia Tomash worked on a book about the medieval geographical imagination. Sara Solari's new book is The Rhetoric of English India. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 624. That's number 624, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, communist leadership during the Cold War and China's Great Leap Forward. Join me for conversations featuring Donald Raleigh of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Jiwei Tsup of the University of International Business and Economics in the People's Republic of China. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Contours, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Sylvia Tomash of Hunter College talks about maps and the medieval geographical imagination. Sara Solari of Yale University discusses literature and colonialism in modern India. Cultural Contours, this week on Soundings.